coming to you from the Barrier Islands Center on Virginia's Eastern Shore. This is Sharing the Mic with David Phillips. In each episode, we try to give you a different perspective of life on the Eastern Shore, whether it's about an occupation or simply stories of what people who have lived here have done in their careers. If you like what you hear, share it with your friends. Sharing the Mic is a monthly podcast, with each new episode appearing the first of each month. My guest is Jim Spione, filmmaker and director of 8 documentaries about the people of the Barrier Islands, the Eastern Shore, and the Barrier Islands Center. Over the past 14 or so years, Jim has become a valuable member of the Barrier Islands Center family. For more information about Jim and the films, go to Sharing the Mic, Season 1, Episode 14, and Season 3, Episode 2. Jim Spione, welcome back to Sharing the Mic. It's good to have you here.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me back. Our third go-round, I believe.
It certainly is. What have you been doing professionally since we last talked?
I've been working for about almost a year now, if you take into account the preparation and research on this film about the property of the Barrier Island Center and its previous incarnation, if you will, as an almshouse, a poorhouse, where it operated on that spot, both in the structure that's there now and then in a previous building in the early part of the 19th century. But it was operating there for about 140 years. And when we were discussing, you know, as we do, what's our next project? And this is the 8th film that I've made with the Barrier Island Center, Sally said, why don't we do something, the history of the place that we're actually inhabiting right now in terms of this building, because we don't know all that much about it, but we've started to discover things about it, because they had, in fact, asked Miriam Riggs, who's the artist who does a lot of the installations there and the displays. They asked her to start doing research about it, and they had started that already. And then they thought, well, what maybe, you know, Jim should get involved and we should translate this fascinating history about this place and about the institution of the almshouse, which is kind of a forgotten American institution. Why don't we translate that into our next film? So that's how the idea came about, when we've been in production and now post-production for about 8 months.
Why do you think the film is important, and what do you hope audiences will gain from seeing it?
It was certainly an education for me, because I really didn't know much about this idea of the almshouse in America. I had no idea how prevalent it was. There was an almshouse or a poorhouse, if you will, in every county, and there were often more of such institutions in any city of any size, and major cities might have more than one. These would be quite large complexes in places like, you know, New York or Boston or Baltimore. You're talking about places that could house thousands of people. Here on the Eastern Shore, the smaller scale poorhouse at the Barrier Island Center site, it was obviously a much different scale. And so there would be anywhere from 10 to maybe 30 people there at any given time. It's a fascinating journey through 100 plus years of Eastern Shore history. The central question really around it is one that still resonates today, I think, which is, what do we do with the least of these? What do we do with people who can't take care of themselves? Back then, there was nothing. There was no social care infrastructure other than the almshouse. And so it fulfilled all of these functions.
I've got to give a disclosure here. I was very honored that you sent me a link to the film so that I have seen it. And one of the things that struck me was the comprehensive nature of the care that people got that is revealed in the film. And I think audiences are going to be quite taken aback when they come to the realization that it was just kind of individuals in the community. I mean, there was some staff at the poorhouse, but it was the local doctor or the local lawyer that got involved and really worked with these people.
Yes, very much so. There was usually one or sometimes more dedicated medical person who would, in fact, that's how often how people ended up in the almshouse, because the doctor would make rounds around the community, go to making house calls essentially, and see that, like, oh, you know, Mrs. Jones is really living in an extreme situation and needs some sort of help and doesn't seem to have that. We're talking about all the way up until probably the 1930s. But these institutions, almshouses, existed well into the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The one in Machapongo here on the Eastern Shore closed in 1946, but there were many that were open for decades past that.
Are there any aspects of the film that you find most poignant?
There are many. I mean, because you're talking about people who, for a number of different possible reasons or multiple reasons, are marginalized, right, from society. I guess there's a level of ostracization to almost any reason you could end up there, is what I want to say. Bernie Herman, the professor at the University of North Carolina, says in the film, this is a debate that's raging in America still. How much help do we owe these people? What do they do in return? That was the case back then as well, you know. So how much money are we spending? You know, let's review the receipts and let's oversee this. And what's the right amount of care, you know? Shouldn't they do work? You know, the most poorhouses, particularly rural poorhouses, were designed as workhouses as well. So this was a working, self-sustaining operation as a farm. You were expected to work. So that idea of that sort of double-edged experience that someone going there is somehow both incredibly humbled and somehow feeling almost put aside or ostracized, maybe like a failure, and then at the same time really grateful that this has been set up to give me some care.
What was the most interesting or unexpected thing that you found out or learned while you were in the process of making this film?
None of this would have happened without Miriam Riggs' years of work. She literally, we see her in the film doing some of this research and accessing some of these documents and talking about them, but she did this for 10 years. That's how long she spent. She has photographed thousands of documents. So it was very deep, detailed research that made this little half-hour movie possible. So there were a lot of fascinating stuff that came out of that, and some of that is right on the wall at the Barrier Island Center in their gallery downstairs. They have a wall where there is a list of names of people that they have so far been able to verify through death certificates. Names of people who are buried right next to the Barrier Island Center in that field there, and most likely into the forest beyond. Miriam thinks there's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 2,000 people who've been buried on that property. And there's no recognizable cemetery or anything. To look at it, you would think it was a farm field and a hedgerow and a forest. So that's quite extraordinary, this idea that, you know, there is the whole almost society of lost souls that's sitting right there just beneath the surface of the soil, that we're all members of this community, going back over 200 years. If you extrapolate on that, you know, there were these almshouses or poorhouses in every community across America. I read one article that estimated there were well over 100,000 of these at one point. So you can imagine there are these cemeteries also that are now unmarked for the most part. So you're talking about probably millions of people across the United States were cared for in these homes at some point, and many of them were buried on site. So that's a really kind of amazing thing to me, to sort of have that past right there below the surface of the soil at the Barrier Island Center, where I've spent a lot of time over the years, and I'm sure many of your listeners have too. It's a really poignant thing to realize. The other poignant thing for me was how the politics of race played out within this institution of sort of already marginalized people, right? And that is, you know, it won't come as a surprise to anybody that it was segregated. It was always segregated up until the time it closed. a little bit of a surprise, but again, if you think about it, probably not too much of a surprise, was the fact that there were slaves, in fact, at the almshouse. So we go into that a little bit in the film, and we, you know, examine the conditions that were afforded African-Americans, both freed people and also during time of slavery, pre-Civil War, and what those conditions were like.
The thing that struck me in the film, it was that the slaves were owned by the almshouse, which in turn means they were owned by the county.
Yes.
Because the county operated the almshouse.
That's right.
And that's just kind of blows my mind. When I think of slavery, I just think of like Simon Legree.
Plantations and so forth.
Individuals owning slaves, but not a government.
Well, but I'm sure it wasn't uncommon, actually. If you think about it, if these places are being run, you know, throughout the South at the time as, you know, working farms, plantations, as it were, then I would imagine that this was not an uncommon practice at all. And you know, the conditions were really harsh for both freed black people as well as slaves. You know, for a good 40 years, they were in the basement, kept in the basement of the original building. And then we detail in the film how that came to change, and there was an interim location for the black residents. They actually called them inmates, by the way. All people who lived there of all races were called inmates, which today sounds a little funny to our ears, but that is the correct term. But the black inmates were transferred into another space outside next to the quarter kitchen, and then finally they had that African-American almshouse built that stands on the property today behind the Barrier Island Center. That didn't happen until 1910, I believe. So that was 100 years before they actually had living quarters that were anything close to what the white inmates had.
I was struck also by the economy of casting. Can you tell us how you came to that decision? It seems in a lot of the other films, you have a lot more interviewees that are talking about various facets of whatever the topic may be. But in this, we have a very brief appearance by Sally Dickinson, the executive director. And then Miriam almost takes on the role of narrator for the whole thing. And then we have a good chunk that Bernie Herrmann has. But then you have these other people who are very important, but have very kind of small slices of the whole thing. I'm just wondering, were there not more people, or did you want to just keep it kind of tight?
Well, I did want this to be, some of our previous films have turned into like little mini epics, if you will. A number of the films were approaching an hour in length instead of which you almost can't call a short film anymore. They're kind of like featurettes. So I wanted to get back to more toward the way we started this series, which was, you know, in Our Island Home, Spirit of the Bird, Waterman, those were all roughly a half hour. And I wanted to get back into that range. So that meant a smaller cast, if you will. I do usually try anyway to have as few voices as can tell the story. So I knew we wanted to have a couple people have vignettes of people who actually had ancestors or relatives there at the almshouse. And so we have a number of those people. And then it was like, who, you know, how can we tell this, the rest of this story? So yeah, it is a little bit different because Miriam, in a sense, is almost a main character in this movie. We're really following her and her experience and how she uncovered this and what that was like for her. We kind of go on the journey with her. She's kind of our guide.
The courthouse here in Eastville is well known as being the oldest continuous collection of public records in America. I thought, oh, well, I'll just go to the public records office, the clerk's office, and seek out some records about the almshouse. However, it wasn't that easy. It took dozens of trips going to various offices. I would find clues in one area, and then that would cause me to go back to another repository of information. It was definitely detective work. And one day, at the end of a long day of negative results, I found this little drawer, and it said Overseer of the Poor Reports on it. There inside were these bundles of documents, and they were tied together with strings and ribbons. And it appeared that they had not been untied in 200 years. I knew what I had been looking for. I knew that if I found something of this type, it would be amazing. You know, it would be revelatory. And it was. It was.
You know, usually in these movies, it is someone like a Bernie Herrmann, or in the film we did about Cobb Island, the last one, it was Dr. Newberry, who was kind of leading us along the way. But that's more of an academic approach. And this feels a little different, right? Because this is a person who's actually, yeah. We're kind of going through this experience of uncovering all of this, this past way of life, really, and what that means and how that reflects on our lives today. So I didn't think we needed more. I guess there are about 8 people in the film, and I didn't think we needed more than that.
Let's talk about how people can see it. I believe it's going to be a world premiere in Cape Charles.
Yes. You know, we had that wonderful screening last summer at the Historic Palace Theater in Cape Charles of the film Gathering. It's just a wonderful space. And I said to Sally, I said, we should just premiere every film there. So that's the plan. We'll be there. The premiere is March 14th. I'll be there, of course, and we'll have a few special guests on stage. I'd like to have a whole panel discussion about the history of this particular almshouse and also, you know, the idea of the poorhouse, the almshouse in general as an institution. It's kind of a forgotten aspect of American society, but it was the social institution in this country for hundreds of years.
What time on the 14th?
The time is at 7:30 p.m.
And is there a cost?
It is 100% free.
Anything else you want to share with us?
I think the one thing we didn't cover was, and again, this is sort of touching on the ostracization theme, was that women who became pregnant out of wedlock were sent to these institutions as well to live and to give birth.
One of the things that I noticed in the film was John Miller, where he talks about his great-great-grandmother who was sent to the almshouse because she had a child out of wedlock who became his great-grandfather. It just sort of blows your mind in this day and age for that circumstance to even exist.
Yeah, so one of the many reasons you could get sent to the almshouse was if you were an unmarried woman who was pregnant, and it was very much part of that was being ostracized, being taken out of the community. And, you know, you go live over there till you have that baby. A clear sort of judgment, moral kind of judgment to it. The father of said baby didn't get sent to the almshouse. The almshouse becomes a fascinating microcosm for societal attitudes of the time, right? All that played out in this little house sitting on the hill here away from the rest of the community. And I assume it was the same way in all of these institutions.
Well, Jim Spione, thank you so much for being on Sharing the Mic.
Oh, thank you. I always enjoy these conversations, and I hope lots of people turn out for the premiere.
Several years ago, Hampton Roads Public Media, WHRO, did a series of short spots called Our Eastern Shore. On each of our podcasts, I will revisit one episode. Listen.
The Wreck of the San Albano. You're listening to Our Eastern Shore. They were tough men and wiry, men of good character, poorly paid, and very courageous. The men of the United States Life-Saving Service, which became part of the United States Coast Guard in 1915. On February 23, 1892, the Spanish steamer San Albano, attempting to dock in Norfolk, missed the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay because of a fierce nor'easter. A surfman of the Hog Island Life-Saving Station fired a Coston flare to warn the vessel of impending disaster. And then station keeper John E. Johnson and his eight men pushed their surf car out into the icy waves and fired a projectile and lifeline across the San Albano's bow. In all, 26 Spanish sailors were saved by the exhausted Hog Island crew. Both the United States government and the government of Spain rewarded the men for their skills and bravery. The complete story of this dramatic sea rescue is on display at the Barrier Island Center. Our Eastern Shore is created by WHRO in partnership with the Barrier Island Center. Funding has been provided by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
You have been listening to Sharing the Mic with David Phillips, produced by the Barrier Island Center on Virginia's Eastern Shore. Sally Dickinson, Executive Director. Kristen Dennis, Office and Marketing Manager. Megan Ames, Director of Planning and Development. Tracy Jones, Director of Education. The Barrier Island Center is located at 7295 Young Street in Machipongo, Virginia, 23405. The website is www.barrierislandscenter.org. If you have comments or questions about this podcast, please direct them to bicpodcast@icloud.com. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe. Until next time, stay safe and be well.